I'm Rick Moore, and this is Connections, a podcast connecting you with news, newsmakers, sports, and entertainment voices all over the North Shore, brought to you by Moynihan Lumber of Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, and by the Institution for Savings, based in Newburyport, with branches throughout the region. All right, with this edition of Connections, I'm really happy to be joined once again by the Reverend Vernon K. Walker, the Policy Director at the Young Massachusetts of Young Democrats of Massachusetts. I get all nervous when I talk to you, Reverend Walker. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing all well. No need to be nervous. It's all smooth and cool. I'm glad to be back here with you this afternoon. It's always a delight and a pleasure to chat with you, Rick.
So, thank you.
No need to be nervous. It's all good.
I'm going to calm down. I watched an edition of Robin Williams on the Johnny Carson show, the first time that Robin Williams was on. I watched it on YouTube the other day, and I couldn't believe how nervous Robin Williams was. So I guess it's not an uncommon thing.
He's such a great actor.
Oh man, it was amazing. All right, listen. Let me get started by asking you maybe do a little reflection. It's been a year now since the George Floyd murder, and the trial has just begun, which is opening up, I'm imagining, new wounds and new thoughts and so on. But after a year, Reverend Walker, with you know, the pandemic, with the crazy stuff coming out of the White House, with the insurrection, with the attacks now, the hate attacks that not only are going on in communities of color, but they're also going on in North Shore neighborhoods in terms of violent language, or in Duxbury, for example, with a football team. What are your thoughts, Reverend Walker, a year later as to where we might be, either locally or nationally?
Well, you know, I think we still are grappling with racism. We are still grappling with the effects or the repercussions of white supremacy. We're still grappling with justice in America. And although we have a new presidential administration, which is very fortunate, and a presidential administration that is taking this virus seriously, a presidential administration that is enacting and pushing for bold policies on climate, that's also pushing for racial justice reform, I think we still have a ways to go. I think that the conversations still continues to be had about what does racial justice look like in America. In some cities and towns and states across the country, conversations are happening around what does reparations look like for black and brown residents, particularly those residents who are descendants of slaves. But I think the reality of it is that it's more than, you know, companies just hiring token black folks, black and brown folks to, you know, to appear to be diverse within their organization, appear to the world to be diverse. It's about what type of ways in which, if it's an organization that's doing social justice, what type of ways in which the organization is wrestling with racial injustice, even if it's an organization that does housing justice or climate justice peace justice work or economical justice work. I think the issue is that racism and racial justice is connected into all of those forms of justice that I just mentioned. So, you know, where we are, you know, the trial is happening, as you mentioned. It, you know, for black and brown folks, it's no new phenomenon to get mistreated by the police. Historically, this has been a problem, and currently, this is still a problem. And the reality of it is that, you know, this is a difficult and pressing issue that, you know, that local leaders should broach and have broached, that national leaders have broached, to an extent, international leaders have broached. But I think we still should find out why there are, you know, schools that are not in inner cities that are not being funded properly, why there are underfunded and under-resourced schools in communities of color, why is neighborhoods crumbling down and violence is rising particularly in cities such as Philadelphia, where gun violence is just spiraling control. And this is something that we need to grapple with. Obviously, city officials in that city are trying to wrestle with that. Religious leaders are trying to wrestle with that. And from what I understand, there seems to be collaboration between some religious leaders, community leaders, municipal elected officials. But the reality of it is that we, you know, the Floyd situation and the George Floyd murder, if you will, it was horrible. It was horrendous. It was outrageous. However, there were still black and brown people killed after the Floyd. Even if you go before the George Floyd situation, Breonna Taylor, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, et cetera, et cetera. And we, you know, there was a young man killed in Philadelphia, I think last fall, when he was charging at the police and they didn't have, like, tasers and they shot him and killed him. So I think there still needs to be some progress. We made some progress, but I think we have much more to go. And to ensure that, you know, black and brown residents have fair and just and equitable opportunities to, you know, have a life where they don't have to be fearful when a police officer pulls them over on the side of the road.
You talk about structural, you talk about culture, you talk about politics and the whole, I don't know, the whole... genesis of where we are at the moment, in all of that, in neighborhoods and in big cities and stuff. You talked about the schools. I want to ask you, can we do a better job in education from, let's say, K to 12 in schools? Not, you know, obviously you have to take care of your inner city schools, and I totally get that and support that. But what I'm asking you, what about the suburban schools? Are we teaching properly? You know, and maybe even schools that, for example, on the North Shore, there are some towns and cities that are predominantly white. Can we do a better job teaching? Will that help in the long run in terms of getting people to understand about all the issues that you're mentioning?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, well, first of all, we need to understand that Christopher Columbus was not a hero. Now, he stole the land of the Native Americans.
Uh-huh.
Instead of maybe celebrating Columbus Day, how about we have Indigenous Day,
mm-hmm.
for an example? I know in some cities and towns,
it's beginning. That's starting.
Yeah, that's starting. I think even in the state of Maine, I could be wrong, but there is one state, I believe, in the country that has, you know, mm-hmm. officially, I believe, changed from Columbus Day to Indigenous Day.
Mm-hmm.
So really telling the truth about white supremacy. But we have to go to the beginning of this American experiment, Rick. So instead of looking at Columbus as being hailed as a hero in 1492, when he allegedly and supposedly discovered America, well, how can you discover something when it was already discovered? There's already people living here. You know, when we talk about racial reckoning and racial justice, you know, maybe teaching the truth behind, you know, institutions or public monuments or public places where a lot of people visit, such as Faneuil Hall. Well, we know Faneuil Hall, you know, it was founded on the blood of slaves, you know, with Peter Faneuil. He sold slaves at Faneuil Hall,
mm-hmm.
and families were separated. You know, I know there was outrage in the last few years of families being separated at the border and parents being separated from children, and we should be outraged by that. Consequently, that happened a few hundred years ago,
mm-hmm.
when Africans were taken. And Africans were treated less than human and chattel slavery and dehumanized and deprived of their God-given rights. So I think what we need to do is get very truthful in school. I think we don't need to whitewash history. We don't need to sanitize history, but we need to be truth tellers about history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think particularly American history, I think for folks, you know, kids that are in the suburbs, in fact, I was just on a call yesterday with Boston Latin Academy. I was particularly talking about climate change, but, you know, bright young folks, obviously that's one of the, you know, premier high schools, one of the premier exam schools in the city of Boston, and it's a very diverse class. And although I didn't really get a chance to get into racial history because my whole purpose for being on that Zoom call, it was sharing about climate adaptation and climate resiliency and climate change, I wanted to digress for a second and say that the kids in the high school should be taught the truth. And the truth is, you know, that there's a brutal legacy that we have to wrestle with here in America. And for our kids, for our kids that are in the inner city, and I went to an inner city school in Philadelphia, you know, it's unfortunate because in history classes, we're not necessarily taught about, you know, Black history in its authentic form. And Black history should be more than just a month, more than just 28 days or 29 days in February, because it's a very rich culture and a very rich heritage. But to answer your question succinctly, I think with our young white brothers and sisters that are coming up in schools and are like going to schools in the suburbs, I think that the curriculum should include a truth telling portion where we don't sanitize history, we don't gloss over slavery, or we don't gloss over the fact that Columbus came to steal the land. And, you know, and those are just some examples.
Mm-hmm, yep. Not only that, but Columbus took a wrong turn. I mean, you know, he got lost, and they hailed him as a hero. And, yeah, all of that. And I didn't discover some of this stuff until very, very later on in my life. And it disturbs me as an educator that we haven't done a better job. And also when I see the insurrection caused by people who follow, the edicts of Trump, it seems to me that we've failed epically in education. For all the good that we've done, we've done a terrible job. And I thank you for that that opinion, because I think we can do a much better job, and we have to do a better job everywhere in terms of educating kids so that when they grow up, they can understand who it is that they're meeting that they may never have seen before in person, but they have an idea of where that person comes from. You know, and as Americans, we can lead the way, I think, or at least do a much better job. And at some point, Reverend Walker, I do want to dedicate one of these conversations to your work on climate change, because I know how near and dear it is to you and how much work you do with that, and I do want to do that. But in the meantime, a couple of other, I guess, political items. The Massachusetts legislature has baffled me. In that, from my perspective, as a layperson, it looks like they are voting themselves against transparency. They every time a vote for transparency, making the legislature more transparent in terms of meetings, in terms of bills and stuff like that, they don't pass it. And I'm at a loss for that. Can you give me a little, information about what's going on?
Well, it is baffling. And there were several hundred signatures collected last year. Districts across the state, and there was at least 200 signatures per petition, per district that was collected. I had a colleague of mine who personally worked on that project. That's how I know about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's atrocious. Act on Mass is continuing the effort, that is the organization leading the charge, because we do need more transparency, in the state house. And our state legislator, because I think constituents have a right to know how their legislators are voting on paper, because, you know, what you say in public, if it's not matched with how you vote behind closed doors, then there's a discrepancy. And if that discrepancy is detrimental to the thriving and the surviving of any community, then we need to call that legislator to the carpet of accountability. And I think the transparency pledge will allow that, and we need that. And folks have been pushing for that for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hopeful, and I'm grateful, and I'm appreciative that Act on Mass will pick it up again, because there's a coalition of progressive groups who are supporting this. Because the reality of it is, we need to know. You know, constituents need to know how their state senators or their state reps are voting on a particular issue. We know it on a federal level. Why don't we have it here on a state level? And I know that Massachusetts builds itself as the a vanguard of change in terms of enacting progressive policies, such as Massachusetts was the first state to abolish slavery, also the first state to legalize it, but nonetheless the first state to abolish it, also the first state to offer a form of universal health care. With the Romney Care in the early part of this century, the first state to legalize gay marriage in 2003, no matter how people feel about that, you know, there's many people who fall on different sides of the issues, and I'm not really here Massachusetts has oftentimes been a champion on for what will be quote unquote progressive policies. You know, the minimum wage has raised up, the Raise Up Coalition helped get the $15 minimum wage, which should be in the next year or two, but it has progressively risen over the last few years. As a result of the coalition's work, we have emergency paid family leave. So, you know, Massachusetts historically has built itself to be the first in many ways and to be the vanguard of change, if you will, such as we're the first state to have a train system, first state to have public education, first state to have a public park, the Boston Garden. Well, we need to be more deliberate and thoughtful on why we are not allowing transparency in our state house. That's the people's house. And the people ought to know,
mm-hmm.
you know, how elected officials vote on particular matters. Because, you know, again, there could be a chasm in what an elected official says in public and in the newspapers and on TV. There could be a chasm that exists from what they say and what they articulate to how they vote on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to know that.
Yeah, well, that's a huge issue, and I've seen a lot of editorials in the local papers about that. And I thank you for that history lesson about Massachusetts as well. I didn't know most of those things. That's fascinating. Reverend Walker, I've kept you for a while, and I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to mention. I, for one, I'm in an age bracket where I have finally gotten the vaccination, and it gives me, as the sun comes out and then the flowers start to bloom, it gives me a new outlook, I think, and it does look as though some of the veil of this heaviness and oppression is beginning to lift. But anything else that you might want to mention?
Yes, please feel free to get vaccinated when you can. I'm so glad to hear about that. I'm receiving my second vaccination shot tomorrow.
Excellent, excellent.
So I just say to the listeners, you know, let us not politicize the coronavirus. And even though it has been politicized for the last year, let us not politicize it, because it's a matter of life and death. And if one can do and act responsible in stopping the transmission of the virus, which from what I understand is a new variant, that potentially could lead to a fourth wave in the United States if we don't try to keep measures in place to contain it. So folks, you know, look at the state, you know, the state registration system. And although there has been some fumbling of that, particularly early on by the Baker administration, you know, check it out, you know, check with your doctor, check with your, physician, because we want to ensure that we can try to reach herd immunity, as the CDC is proposing. And we want to make sure that people are safe and lives are not lost because of this awful, awful virus.
Amen to that. It is the Reverend Vernon K. Walker, who is the policy director of the Young Democrats of Massachusetts. With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore. This has been Connections, a podcast connecting you with news, newsmakers, sports, and entertainment voices all over the North Shore. Brought to you by Moynihan Lumber of Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, by the Institution for Savings, based in Newburyport, with branches throughout the region. Connect with Connections by emailing msonewsports@gmail.com.